This is Mame Warren. Today is the 5th of December, 1995, and I'm at Gulchley with Tom and Jane Riegel, R-I-E-G-E-L. And Tom Riegel has been on the faculty of Washington and Lee. He began in 1930, is that correct?
That is correct.
You know, what I would be really interested in hearing from you is what your impressions were when you first arrived. I know very little about Washington and Lee in that time period, in the 30s. What was it like when you first got here?
Well, I should immediately respond that I didn't know much about Washington and Lee either when I arrived here for the first time. I really had not been south of the Mason and Dixon line very much, if at all, at that time. And I came down for an interview primarily because I needed a job. And this sounded attractive. And so I came down here and I was fascinated by the journey here, taking a sleeper, I think, in those days down the valley of Virginia and waking up in the morning in Buena Vista among those mountains. And I was impressed. I thought this was really sensational. Well, anyway, I went to the university and was very warmly received. I liked everyone. It seemed to be a very friendly place, and one that had promise for useful work with a chance to develop some of my own ideas. And so I said, well, why not try it? I had, of course, to discuss this with my future bride. I was engaged in that. I think I came first in the spring, didn't I, for an interview?
Yes, you did.
I believe.
It was about Easter time, I think.
Yeah.
Interview.
Yeah. And then I came back in September. By that time, I had accepted the position, I presume.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think you had accepted it maybe on the spot. I'm not sure. Yeah. About on the spot, but.
Well, I had a chance that fall, before we were married, to introduce my future bride to my friends and members of the faculty and so on. And she seemed to be quite happy with everyone we met. And so we said, why not? Let's try it. And it turned out quite well.
Now, what did you come here to do? What did they invite you to do, and what did you have in mind to do when you arrived?
Well, they had a recently established Department of Journalism. That was established, I think, in 1925 or 1924 because of an endowment raised by the Southern Newspaper Publishers Association. And the first director, I think, was
Ellard,
yeah, Roscoe B. Ellard. And he had as an assistant William L. Maple, and they were both from the University of Missouri School of Journalism. And Ellard left in, at the time I came. In other words, it was essentially a two-man department with a printing assistant in charge of the printing laboratory. But when the head of the department, Ellard, left, Maple became the head of the department, and I was hired as an assistant professor.
And where did you come from?
Well, my dubious career before that time included early youth in Reading. I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania, and we lived in Missouri and Iowa and Wisconsin. Most of my high school days were spent in Wisconsin, and I went to Lawrence College there for 2 years and then to the University of Wisconsin. And after graduation, I came back east to Reading and worked on the newspaper there the Reading Tribune for a year, and then went to Paris. I wanted to see the world, and I belonged to the so-called lost generation, I presume, but I was a contemporary of some of the well-known expatriates. And in Paris, I ran out of money, and so I dropped in at the Chicago Tribune Paris edition to see if I could get a job, and they offered me one at once, and I went to work there. And I was there about a year, I guess. Do you want all of these details?
Sure.
And decided I had been in Europe long enough that I was an American and I'd better get back to my own country. And I came back and got a job through my brother. My brother was an historian teaching at Dartmouth College. And he suggested to the head of the English department that I might be interested in a job there. And so I was offered one, and I worked 2 years as an instructor in English, in the English department at Dartmouth. And then I had to do something because they didn't want to keep me on there unless I had further education. So I decided somewhat reluctantly to go to graduate school, and I enrolled in Columbia and for a course in for an MA in American literature. And then when I got out in 1930, we were having a depression, and I have a little trouble remembering exactly what was going through my mind. But I decided that this was a good time to get a job and work for a little while until I decided what I wanted to do. I was quite sure that I didn't want to go on in graduate school, so I had to find an alternative. And so when I heard about this job in a remote small university in the South, I said, why not? Let's try it. And that is what happened. Is that the story, my dear?
Yeah, it's very good to know, yeah. It's a made-up story.
Yeah, but is it plausible? That's the question.
Yeah,
will they buy it? Will they believe it?
Yeah.
So when you arrived, what was Lexington like? What was Washington and Lee like?
Well, this is, of course, difficult to recall. There's been a lot of memory made since those days, and it sometimes gets a little confusing. But we found it a very quiet, agreeable, friendly, social. In fact, it became almost too social later on, a few years later. The faculty was young, active, and somewhat alcoholic. You don't have to put that in. But it was a gentler age, and there seemed to be very little professional envy, jealousy, empire building, and that kind of thing that I have since encountered in various places. I think we were remarkably free of it. Most of us, or at least in our group, were young and relaxed and not driven by demons of ambition or scholarly approval and all that kind of thing. There wasn't the pressure that suggests the important point that there wasn't a great deal of pressure on members of the faculty, as I knew it, to produce or perish. Do you think so, Jan?
No.
Actually, I was a producer. I did a lot of work all the time, but this was voluntary. I was aware of no pressure to do it. Other members of the faculty, I think, were notable for being very humane, tolerant, easygoing. I don't know, in a sense, a kind of ideal Mr. Chips type of professor. characters too, individuals, people like Cutie Easter, for instance, the professor of French, very likable, lovable little man with a rubicund smile. Do you remember him?
Yes.
And who were some of the others?
Well, Dr. Howe.
Yeah, Dr. Howe and chemistry. And these are all decent, civilized people with whom it was a pleasure to be. And the, yeah, well, do you think of anything else there?
You mentioned that the journalism department had just recently been established.
About 5 years.
Now, can you straighten me out? I thought that there was some connection with Robert E. Lee himself having established some school of journalism, but that didn't last long, is that?
Well, on that table over there, I have laid out any amount of material that you, for you, if you're interested. That on the left is personal, on the right is the department, and some general things on some of our outside activities of the department are in the middle. Among other things, I have a pamphlet that gives you the history of Robert E. Lee and so on, and I'd better look that up.
Okay.
The story is that Robert E. Lee, God, I've heard Gaines tell this story so often that I should know it by heart. After the war, well, you know the story of how he came to Lexington to become the president of this little Washington College. And he thought that the New South, rising from the troubles of the Civil War, needed primarily wisdom and guidance in professional fields, law, business, was it? Business management, and journalism. Needed good newspapers and informed editors. And his ideal was a little nebulous as far as journalism is concerned, except that he thought of the setting up and did set up scholarships for young newspaper men or editors, maybe they were, of the southern newspapers, giving them a year at Washington College, which included working for the local paper, the Gazette, I guess. I'm not sure what the paper was at that time. And they were, in a sense, printers, these young people. And Ellard claims to have met people who had actually come here on a Robert E. Lee scholarship under this plan. But at any rate, this was the inspiration for the SNPA, the Southern Newspaper Publishers, I'm giving you a very bad account of this thing, but I just want to convey the idea, the main idea. And they saw in this bit of history a possibility of a useful memorial to Robert E. Lee by founding a school where he was and which had the same ideal of training good men to run the public media of the South. And so they raised some money and established a school.
Now, was it Ellard who was the moving force behind this?
No, there was another chap whose name I've forgotten who preceded him and raised the money. I had those records for a while of what they raised and from whom.
Well, I actually found a reference to that in the Alumni magazine just this morning, so I do have some of that information, but it was presented sort of as an established fact, so it didn't give too much background, so I'm very interested in what you're saying. Now, is this related to, Frank asked me to ask you about the Lee Memorial Journalism Foundation. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, that's why we gave it that name. Now, who gave it that name? Did I give it that name? I can't remember.
I have a feeling you might have, because...
Well, this happened early, with, of course, the approval of Gaines and the Glass family.
He wasn't here until 1930.
Yeah, he and I
so
came the same year.
So it was after that. It was after 1930 that that happened.
Yeah.
And you raised money from the SNPA, too.
Yeah.
And the Virginia Press Association.
Well, I used to give an annual report to the Southern Newspaper Publishers Association. And we had a very active, close relationship. And that began to change, of course, when all the states and many private colleges developed journalism courses. So these papers felt a primary loyalty toward their own state school.
Well, so that was the only journalism school for a long time.
Yes, that's right.
Instruction in journalism as an entity.
Well, at any rate, the idea of this title, Lee Memorial Journalism Foundation, was to memorialize the reason for its existence, which was, of course, true, legitimate, and also to have an entity to which contributions could be made in honor of General Lee and in the pursuit of improved education for journalists in the South. Does that answer?
Mm-hmm. And when was this foundation established?
Now, there you've got me.
But that was some ways into your tenure when you were here? You'd been here for a while?
Yes, I think so. Yes. Don't you, Jay?
I have a feeling that it was, yes, because there must have come a time when you needed a name for it.
Yes.
When you were actively asking the Publishers Association to kick in with equipment and money and so forth and so on.
Yeah, I believe that's right. It's, of course, very inconsequential in my memory. That in itself was no great thing, just a matter of printing a title.
Frank was curious about what's happened to that foundation and why it doesn't get talked about much anymore.
Well, because my successors ignore it, I would say. I use the stationery. As long as I was there.
There was another, I think there was a little fuss about using it as a foundation, that was for the journalism school, wasn't it? That's when that happened, when you had to drop the journalism school.
Yeah, there was a period when somebody came in, who was it? One of the more corporation-minded presidents. When any departmental initiative in raising money was discouraged, it was all supposed to be under the university.
The general fund.
And I'm sure there would have been objection to a separate foundation for raising the money if it had ever come to showdown.
I think the idea was to have it, the Lee Memorial Journalism School, and that had to be thrown out because it actually was not a school.
Yeah, it wasn't a school.
University.
Yeah. Explain the distinction you're making there.
Uh-huh.
Between a school and a department? I am not a good academician. No, I am not. I'm serious about that. I have paid very little attention to the niceties of academic protocol. But a school means several departments, I think, plus a dean, and an elaborate, claptrap, elaborate system of organization, whereas a department is just deals with one subject and has no dean, it just has the head of the department. That's my understanding, but I am no expert. Is that what you understand, my dear?
Yeah, and I have a feeling that it came from the top, but there was some talk about in the administration, that this was not a school,
For
that reason.
Well, in the organization of this university, for instance, The deans are responsible to the president, and the department heads are responsible primarily to their deans, and then on up to the president. But the heads of departments report to Elrod. Well, he's president now, but to the dean. Am I comprehensible?
Actually, when you were having requirements, seems to me in the 30s, 40s, the journalism department was behaving like a school.
Yes.
Because you didn't report to the dean ever, did you? Any of the deans, the dean of the university?
Not really.
It seems to me you had
dealings
with Dr. Gaines.
Yes. I was given great liberty. I don't think it's that way anymore. I don't know.
It appears to me maybe this is why the other departments got uppity.
When did you become the head of the department?
Well, I came in 1930, and the next year, Maple went on a leave of absence to the American Boy, didn't he?
Someplace.
And then he came back for a year. And then left again, so that I became the acting head of the department in 1934. And I was left in this sort of limbo as acting head. I guess I was pretty young for it and hadn't been here very long. At any rate, nobody did anything about changing my title until a professor of history. I remember this quite well. What was his name? Helderman.
Leonard
Helderman. Yeah. Brought it up to the president or somebody, and he said, well, this is ridiculous. Why don't you make him head of the department, since he is that and has been? So I suddenly got a promotion and a new title along about. Then I became the real, not acting head, but head about when, 1938? About 3 or 4 years later.
It's in that thing. Where is your...
Yes, I have it here.
Yeah,
we can look it up.
It's in the curriculum.
So, what does it mean to be a department head?
What does it mean?
Yeah. What does a department head do?
I can't speak for the university or other departments at all. All I know is my own limited experience with one department. And I happen to be associated with a department which was ambiguous. That is, this was a new discipline, that to use the terrible cliche, in the academic world, and the curriculum had not yet been frozen in cement, as I think maybe it has begun to become in recent years. In other words, what was taught in departments of journalism depended a great deal upon the special interests of the people who ran them, and they were very different. And the one at Washington and Lee is certainly a good example of the department reflecting the major interests of the man in charge. When I came to Washington and Lee in the first year, I was teaching courses in short story writing and literary criticism, who's the first guy, you know?
Ellen
came from an English department, and he had introduced those courses, and I just kept them going. Well, that's just an example. They were dropped very quickly, and I was sort of feeling my way, and I had my special interests were, of course, the other media besides print, literature. I was interested in visual arts, graphic arts, which made me very much interested in introducing something in the motion picture, and of course later in radio and television as they developed. And also I had a very great interest in political manipulation, the way masses of people are moved and what moves them, and the strategies and techniques and effects of all kinds of attempts to mold opinion, to form opinions and to change opinions and to solidify opinions. And all of that, of course, appeared in when the department introduced courses in such things as public opinion and propaganda and subjects of that type.
Well, that was early on, too.
Yes.
No, was that...
This book came out in 1934.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my book called Mobilizing for Chaos.
So that must have been very topical as the years developed. I would think that you would have been very much in demand World War II came along.
Well, I was pretty busy. I did a lot of lecturing, writing of articles and reviews in the 30s. In fact, I had a dozen irons in the fire, to coin a phrase, and I signed a release. I guess I better not say that.
What?
I may have neglected my primary duties a little because of my numerous duties elsewhere. Well, then, of course, I was...
They're going to come get you now. The boogeymen are going to come get you.
So many things happened then. I became one of the editors of the POQ about this time. Was that book? That was before the war, wasn't it?
Yeah, it must have been.
What's
the
POQ?
Public Opinion Quarterly, which is still being published. I was on the original board of editors. And then, of course, when we entered the war, and quite early in the war, I was approached and asked to join in the propaganda information agency. And you know about that, I guess.
I wish you would tell me.
Well, let's see. I got the call about the end of 1941, shortly after Pearl Harbor, and the people were beginning to scuttle around to quickly build up an agency to carry on the information and propaganda services. And I won't go through all of the changes that occurred, but just limited to my story. I was asked to come to Washington, or was it New York? No, I guess it started in Washington, about January of 1942.
Yeah.
And then I left the campus on leave in February, I think, and went to Washington for a while and worked for the OSS, the Foreign Information Service, a branch of General... What the hell was his name? OSS. Until... oh, dear me, June or July, I guess, the OWI was established in June of 1942, I believe.
The Office of War Information?
Yes. And I transferred to that. I was in Washington for a little while and then went to New York as the principal propaganda analyst was my title. And I worked there from then on in New York. The next development within the organization was the language sections directed toward different parts of the world. And I began by being made the director of the section for Central and Southeastern Europe. Don't ask me why. I was just standing around there, and they said, why not? Anyway, this was a very useful and educational experience for me. because I found myself more or less supervising the work of the propaganda for all these countries, including Italy, by the way, at the beginning, and then all the way others, Poland, Hungary, Greece, etc., down the list. And I did that for a while, and then we established a review board in New York, which had general supervision of all of the different propaganda sections. For instance, there was one for the British Empire and one for the enemy, German, and so on. And then we had a central board in New York which approved all the projects, which initiated propaganda projects to these places, or if they originated elsewhere, we studied them and either approved or disapproved of them. And I eventually I was a member of the board for a while representing Central and Southeastern Europe, and then I became the chairman of this board. And I was there until I went to Europe during most of 1944, was it? When did I go to Europe, do you remember? January of 45. Well,
so you were in New York most of the time?
Yes, I was in New York.
You were fighting the Battle of the Hudson.
That's right, yeah.
My father fought the Battle of the Potomac.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Well, am I boring you?
Not at all. Not at all.
We were beginning to move people to Europe behind the troops, and somebody had gone to Italy ahead of me. The guy from Time, what was his name?
Lennon,
James Lennon, yeah. And I followed not long after that as a general representative of OWI for Italy and the Balkans. And I was told that I was the first purely civilian person to go to the Mediterranean theater of war.
So you were never in the military in all this time? You remained a civilian?
Well, I was never in the military. I did have a simulated rank. I had an ID which identified me as a colonel. In case I was captured, I was to be treated like a colonel. But otherwise, I was never in the military, no. And I was to represent the coming civilian personnel that would follow the military. The military was so-called forget it. But then, at any rate, there was a military-directed organization which had in its composed of military propagandists and the OWI and the British were represented in it too, in the Mediterranean theater this way. Well, then I was in Italy until the end of July, wasn't it? I can't get up. I'm wired down. But I'm writing a memoir now, and I was going to show you what I have so far. It's a book this big called Hacking It, and you find all of this stuff in there.
you mean you're not letting her read it?
No, she read all that. I have more kindness than that. Well, I went there in July, and I was there Wait a second, Jane.
One of our good sons put it on the...
Wow.
He's in 1945 now.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, when did I leave Italy?
In August, I think. You've just written that, you should remember. It was August.
Yeah.
early in August.
Yeah, that's right. I am now in
Budapest.
Slovakia in December of 1945. Well, I went to Hungary as a special assistant to the minister, Schoenfeld, and I was also the press officer and the cultural attaché, and I stayed there until the following June of 1946. And I'm writing the Budapest part of the memoir, and it happens that on December 2nd, I made a side trip into Slovakia to Kasha, Poprad, Starý Smokovets, and some of those places, and I found it a very dramatic experience, and I'm spending a little time on that. But that's a side track. I'm getting off the subject. Then I was told the President Gaines was very happy to see me leave in 1942. He didn't conceal his elation because he was he had no students and he was trying to get rid of his faculty.
Is that true?
Oh, yes, yes. I remember that last interview with him when he said, "Oh, Professor, I certainly am sorry to see you go, but we have to do our patriotic duty and we're glad to give you a leave of absence." And I knew all the time that he was tickled to death. He wanted to get rid of the faculty.
Tell me about that period when that transition was happening. Did you stay in Lexington or did you, through the whole war?
No, I stayed until...
Well, let me finish this and I'll go back to it.
Please.
So in the summer I checked with Gaines, did he want me back? And oh yes, he sure did. Those only students were coming back from the army. So I came back and was here and resuming my duties in the fall of 1946. All right, now we'll go back to 1942. Well, as the war approached, there was a lot of recruiting going on, and a lot of people, of course, saw the writing on the wall and tried to get in. He had an early start in the armed forces. One of the chief actors in this scenario was Larry Watkin, who joined the Navy and became a recruiting officer. And it was because of Larry that many of the Washington and Lee faculty enlisted in the Navy. We have a lot of them, as you have probably discovered.
And students, too.
Who?
And students, too.
And students, too, yes. So during the season of 41-42, there were a lot of defections. A lot of people were beginning to leave the university. Some of them had commissions of one sort or another, reserve people like Charlie Light, who had a military status of some sort in the Judge Advocate General's office, and he went away fairly early, I think, I recall, because of that. And those who didn't have military connections, as I say, were recruited. Roly Nelson was another one who joined because of Larry Watkin. And Larry got him a pretty good job as a naval attaché in Brazil.
So what did that feel like at that time in Lexington? Was it, were things in real turmoil? Was it feeling like a ghost town? What was happening?
Well, while this was going on, of course, some of us were pacifists, and like myself. I was opposed to not to this war particularly, but that's another story. But at any rate, I had no objection to serving my country on Pennsylvania Avenue. As long as I didn't kill anybody, I was happy. And so this suited me fine, because I was interested in what we were trying to do. I was certainly an ardent opponent of the Nazi movement and so on, so I could do this with good heart and sincerity. But I think this is true of most people the same way. But then the university, as you know, got these schools, special schools, School of Special Services. You know about that.
I'd like you to tell me what you know.
Well, I don't know anything about it because I left. Mm-hmm. But there was one, and there are people around here who could tell you about it who were in it. Who?
Nobody anymore.
Oh, I have some names of people to talk to, but I'm real interested in this transition period.
We lived on McDowell Street at the time. Jane stayed here until I moved to New York.
Yeah.
And sometime after I was in New York in 1943, she packed up her 5 children.
No, I didn't either. I had 2 children.
Well, there were only 2 then, weren't there?
Yes.
Yeah, and took them to New York, and we got an apartment at 460 Riverside Drive, and we lived there as a family until I went to Europe.
But here in Lexington, was it a very gradual thing that the members of the faculty were leaving, or did everybody just go quickly?
I'd say the answer is yes to both of those.
Yes to both, that's right. Some people pulled out fast, for instance.
But my wife would have to talk. She was here and I wasn't.
I was here for years, but he was.
Yeah, well, how about that?
Yeah, people were pulling out. Well, for instance, your assistant, the one who took over the journalism department, Bob Hodges. We thought he was in for we thought he was here to take over your job. And very shortly after you left, he went into the service, I believe, and left. And you had to get, let me think, where in the world were you?
We had the former dean of the Columbia School of Journalism there for a while. I never even met him. That all happened while I was away. Do you remember that?
What was his name?
I can't remember his name.
Is that Skinner?
No. Skinner was a printer.
I never met him either.
Well, he was fairly well known. He was as well known as the other one whose name is on the end of my tongue and I can't remember.
What was it like to see the students go? And especially if you were a pacifist and you know that these young men were headed off to really fight in this war. What was that like?
Well, I left before most of the students, I think. So that's hard to answer. Let's see. Well, I have no particular recollection except that I felt the general mood of the time, which was one of cooperation and patriotism, if you want to call it that. I am not a patriot, but I think there was a general agreement with the policy and people were interested in getting it over with, and we respected people who went to war then. I do remember that I had many visits in New York from students who would come to see me in their uniforms. Jack Neal is an example, and Bob, the Missouri publisher, what was his name?
White.
Robert White, yeah, Bob White and others would show up in their Navy uniforms and we would have very nice reunions. But I don't remember anything any trauma or any special.
Obviously the student body was decreasing. And not only the student body, but the faculty was leaving.
Yes.
And then suddenly the School for Special Service came in, which took care of the physical plant. And seems to me there was a building out back of the print shop there that was a hush-hush. No, at the print shop.
Yes, that's right.
The hush-hush building.
I think that was an alternative communication center of some kind.
Yes.
In case the ones in Washington were demolished by atomic bombs. The communications would go through Lexington, through the campus in Washington, D.C.
But it was rather gradual, but as I say, as the School for Special Service came in, as I recall, they were here
for
6-week stints.
I just happen to think that Bill Buchanan gave a paper to that club on that operation during the war, and his attempts to find out what was actually going on in this building.
Yeah.
And he found 2 or 3 elderly women around here, contemporaries of ours, as a matter of fact, who had worked there and whose lips still were sealed. They thought they had to keep this quiet. And Bill was in the quandary, what can we do about this? Should we introduce a bill in Congress to release them from secrecy pledges?
I've heard that. Somebody at a party told me that there is some woman in town who to this day will not talk about what she did for special services.
Yeah, that's right.
I need to turn my tape over.